Well, as soon as Samantha found out that I was preaching, she very quickly planned a trip to visit her mother and father in Michigan, as far away as she could get. But Mom and Dad are here. I guess they didn't want me to feel completely abandoned, so it's always good to have backup, I guess. Anyway, it's good to be with you tonight. It's good to see you. I really appreciate this opportunity to stand before you. It's always a good learning experience for someone who doesn't get to speak a lot to get the opportunity. And it's always, it usually ends up being more beneficial for the speaker than it does the audience, but hopefully you'll be able to glean something from it. You know, it used to be that most boys in this area all played football. I mean, nearly every one of them. That's not really the case much anymore. It's really more the exception nowadays for to come across a young man that still plays football. And I guess it's kind of become, I guess people are just starting to get more nervous and a little more antsy about it. Maybe they don't want their children to get hurt or something to that effect. And we kind of see this growing trend throughout the years. We saw it from my parents' generation down to us, where we're getting a little more careful, we're getting a little more safety conscious. You know, some of the stories my dad tells that they did, you know, makes me cringe. And then when I think about some of the things I did, and I think about Titus or Maddie doing those things, you know, I start cringing. We just kind of start seeing this trend of tending to be a little more safe, trying to be a little more careful. And I guess that's okay, but one thing that's a little concerning, I guess, maybe to me, is that maybe there's this mentality coming to us that's making us a little more weak, a little soft about certain things, and I think that could possibly bleed over into our spiritual lives. And so that's some of the things I'm wanting to talk about tonight. I know my experience with football was very valuable, and that it taught me to how to handle criticism. When you were not being criticized, aka yelled at, that's when you got worried when you were playing football, because at that point they've given up on you. But as long as you were being yelled at, everything was okay, because they're just trying to correct you and steer you in the right direction. We were taught to ignore insignificant problems. I believe the exact quote was, "If you can't see the bone, get back to the huddle." We didn't take that literally, but the mentality was there. And then also, when we were taught to rise to situations when they presented themselves. Whether that situation was a large defensive tackle that started 4 years at Tennessee later on. Those situations were presented to us so that we could rise to those occasions and prove ourselves. But obviously, I'm not telling you to go out and sign your kids up for football, unless you want to. I'm not going to discourage that either. But what I am saying is that maybe we need to be a little more mindful of opportunities that can help us toughen our kids and ourselves for the upcoming spiritual challenges that may be coming. Take a look at Jeremiah chapter 12 and verse 5. Now, up to this point, Jeremiah has just spent four verses, for lack of a better term, whining to the Lord and complaining about some of the things that have been going on around him. And so here's how the Lord answers him in the ESV. "If you have raced with men on foot and they have wearied you, how will you compete with horses? And if in a safe land you are so trusting, what will you do in the thicket of the Jordan?" You know what the Lord is telling Jeremiah? You better toughen up. It's about to get tougher. And I think that's what we need to do. Tough times are coming. And if you don't think they are, go back and listen to the lessons from Brother Larry Rouse. Internal struggles are going to be coming from inside the church. And if you want to know about struggles from outside the church, all you got to do is turn the TV on for about 5 minutes. Tough times are getting tougher, and we need to toughen up accordingly and get ready. So let's talk about a few ways that we can toughen up as Christians. I think the first thing we need to do is grow some skin. can you just imagine if somebody, you know, ripped a big piece of skin off your arm, or for that matter, your whole body, and then you tried to live your life? Could you imagine how sensitive everything would be? I mean, you couldn't stand to do anything, right? Well, don't a lot of us do that emotionally? Don't we walk around without skin emotionally a lot? Every little thing that happens tends to affect us. Every little thing gets to us. Every little thing that happens that we hear or anything that's said stings us. We've got to be able to grow some skin. We get offended way too easily. And you know, when you're that sensitive to things, even a compliment can seem like it stings. You know what I'm talking about? You know, somebody may say, well, you know, that shirt does look nice today. And you're like, well, what, do I normally dress like a slouch? You know, we get so hypersensitive to everything, even good things can be seem to be bad. But I tell you, another thing we've done is we have trivialized the definition of the word offend. You know, we look at the word offend as hurting our feelings. But if you look at the way the Bible defines offend, look at Mark chapter 9 and verse 43. Different versions render this differently, but in the King James, if thine hand offend thee, cut it off. Now, what does that say in other versions? If you're in the New King James, if your hand causes you to sin, cut it off. So the Bible's definition of offend is much more severe than what we've come to know as the definition of offending, of being offended. And so we need to quit being so sensitive to everything that happens and quit being offended by just little trivial matters. We also need to remove ourselves from being the center of the world. I know it's just human nature, but every little thing that's said, we tend to point it at us, right? You know, somebody may make a general comment about, boy, the singing was just a little off this morning. Well, now we're thinking, oh, well, what was I doing about the singing? You know, was I messing up the singing? Was I the one that was off key? Was I singing too loud? Or something to that effect. Every little thing that's said, we tend to start making about us, and we start losing sleep over it. And when the person may not have even been talking about you at all. And so we've got to get our mind off of ourselves. We do that with everything, don't we? We tend to apply everything to ourselves instead of removing ourselves from the center of the world and looking at something objectively. And when we do that, when we tend to apply everything to us, it may blind us to the real situation of what's going on. We look at it from our standpoint and completely missing that somebody's actually needing help over here because you didn't even notice that because you're too busy thinking about what the comment meant to you. So, you know, we have to make sure that we're not thinking about ourselves all the time because we're just going to blind ourselves to what's happening with others. We also need to rightly discern criticism when it's given to us. Take a look at Proverbs chapter 10 and verse 17. He who keeps instruction is in the way of life, but he who refuses correction goes astray. When somebody comes to us with a criticism, you know, we really tend to burr up, don't we? We tend to just start getting emotional. We get defenses. We start trying to explain why so-and-so happened, or no, that didn't happen, or I didn't do that, or something to that effect. But what we really need to do is when someone comes to us with a criticism, you know, they may not deliver it very well sometimes. We're not all real good at that. So we need to make sure that we're able to remove the delivery from the situation. We need to remove our emotion from the comment and look at it objectively and then take it and look at it as a mirror and say, okay, does this really apply to me? Does this criticism mean something to me? Is that true? Is that something that I need to correct? And if it is, then we need to adjust to it accordingly. In Proverbs 19 and verse 20, We're advised to listen to counsel and receive instruction, that you may be wise in your later days. So I think that, you know, I think that would probably help us in a lot of situations in general. If we were able to control our emotions enough to take the emotion out of what's being said or what's being presented to us, then we could probably do a lot better in learning and taking things and applying them to our lives. I don't know if it's possible, but maybe pretend that it's a robot telling you what's going on, because you know the robot don't care one way or another. But we need to be able to remove the emotion from the situation or the comment or the criticism so that we can rightly discern if it applies to us. And I tell you something that's kind of difficult is if you do decide that it is something helpful and useful to you, go and thank the person. Say, you know, thank you for bringing that to my attention. Since you pointed that out, I can now see that there's an adjustment I need to make, and I'm going to try to do better and do that. So thank the person. Go back to them. And if it doesn't apply, forget it. Let it bounce off the skin that you've grown. Just let it go. It's okay. Take a look at James chapter 5 and verse 19. It says, "Brethren, if anyone among you wanders from the truth and someone turns him back, let him know that he who turns a sinner from the error of his way will save a soul from death and cover a multitude of sins." So if someone is coming to you, you can almost guarantee that they're not doing that lightly. They're taking their responsibility listed here very seriously. And so they've gotten up the nerve to come to you and bring and try to help you. So try to keep that mentality in mind as well as you're discerning this. And so don't get upset with the person. But you should think more highly of that person, that they think enough of you to come correct you. Secondly, in order to toughen up, we've got to quit whining. That's something we've been working on our kids. I don't know if we're making much headway, but we're trying. It really doesn't accomplish anything to whine. You ever notice that? We've gotten to where at work, you know, just about every time you ask somebody, "Well, how you doing?" You know, we'll say, "Well, we can't complain," or "We can't gripe." And then the other person says, "Well, they wouldn't listen if you did anyway, would they?" And so you hate to admit it, but that's kind of the truth, isn't it? You know, complaining doesn't really seem to accomplish anything. The only thing it does seem to accomplish is to get others discouraged. You know, you're going to everybody else and whining and complaining about everything else, and, you know, I'm as guilty as anybody. That's not uplifting to whoever it is you're griping and complaining and whining to. That person starts thinking about that situation, and then they start getting discouraged, and it just keeps going and going, and who knows, they may start going and whining about it to somebody else. So it can be very discouraging to others. And something else it does, it keeps your mind occupied with whatever your worry is. Your mind is now so consumed on that because you keep whining and complaining about it. Well, now you don't even have time to look at what you need to be looking at and being concerned with what you need to be concerned with and tending to the things you need to think of. And most importantly, whining makes God angry. If there is anybody that you do not want to be angry, it's God. Ask the children of Israel. Look at Numbers chapter 21. Numbers chapter 21 and verse 4, starting in verse 4. "When they journeyed from Mount Hor by the way of the Red Sea to go around the land of Edom, and the soul of the people became very discouraged on the way. And the people spoke against God and against Moses, 'Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there is no food and no water, and our souls loathe this worthless bread.'" Now, how did the Lord feel about that? Verse 6. "So the Lord sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people, and many of the people of Israel died. Now I know if we took a poll of this audience, you would either despise spiders or you'd despise snakes. So imagine your situation if every time you whined, a bunch of snakes or a bunch of spiders came and started crawling around you, started coming after you. That might help you. Think about it the next time that you start whining. God is not appreciative of whining at all. And it might help us to remember that those things that we're whining about, it was probably our fault to begin with. Let's take a look at James chapter 4. In James chapter 4, starting in verse 1, "Where do wars and fights come from among you? Do they not come from your desires for pleasure at war in your members? You lust and do not have. You murder and covet and cannot attain. You fight and war, yet you do not have to, but you do not have because you do not ask. You ask and do not receive because you ask amiss, that you may spend it on your pleasures." So what's James telling them about their complaining and their whining? It's your own fault. These problems are your own fault. Do we not do that? Do we not exactly? Does that not happen to us every time? I mean, think about it. If we have no money, you think it might be because of our spending habits? Now, there's exceptions to these, obviously. But our health, if our health is bad, could it be because of our eating habits? Could it be because we smoke or we drink? Maybe not, but there's most of the time it is. When we complain about church, are we there? Do we participate? Are we doing what we can do to make things better? Usually when we whine, we're the cause. And you know, when we really stop and think about it, do we really have anything to whine about? We have a Savior that came and died that we can have that hope to live with God. He cleanses our sins. We have our brethren when we get down. We have our brethren to lean back on when we're struggling. You know, if we are hungry, do you think our brethren are going to let us starve? If we really get in financial straits, are our brethren going to let us just go down the drain? We have our brethren. And one of the things that should be the most obvious to us, at least us in this room, we're Americans. We had a study recently and we got to talking about how we always think about things in terms of America. We don't ever really put ourselves in the mindset of other countries. You know, really struggling in this country, really, really struggling, means you may have a one-room apartment without cable. Now, there are some homeless people out there. We recognize that. But that's the way we perceive things. You know, if we're sitting in a one-room apartment without a car and without cable, boy, we're rough. It's rough. It's out there. I mean, and we probably even have air conditioning in that one-room apartment. But just the simple facts that we're Americans tells us that we don't have a whole lot to be whining about. We have free access to the gospel without any conflict whatsoever. There is no reason that we need to be whining. We also need to be content. The obvious place to look when we're talking about contentment is Philippians chapter 4. In Philippians chapter 4, starting in verse 11, "Not that I speak in regard to need, for I have learned in whatever state I am to be content. I know how to be abased, I know how to abound. Everywhere in all things I have learned to be both full and hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. So we see there the Apostle Paul's attitude. Do you think he was sitting around whining when he's writing this type of thing? I don't think so. He learned to be content. You know, if anybody had a reason to whine, it would have been Jesus. But look at Isaiah 53 and that prophecy about him, starting in verse 7. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. He was led as a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. Jesus, facing death, did not find a reason to whine. We know it was quite the opposite in that situation. Contentment brings us peace, but the lack of contentment can be very detrimental to us. Proverbs chapter 17, verse 22. A merry heart does good, like medicine, but a broken spirit dries the bones. So when we look at things negatively, it has a negative impact on our life. And as all these studies and all these things has talked about with stress, we can see it can also have a negative impact on our health. And so contentment is what we need to strive for. Being content in whatever situation we may find ourselves. The third thing we need to do to toughen up is we just need to do what needs doing. Look at James chapter 4 and verse 17. He says, therefore, to him who knows to do good and does not do it, to him it is sin. So James is telling us that if we know there's something we need to do, we need to do it. We need to just step up and do it. And some things that we need to step up and do is going to be tough to do. And we need to be able to rise to that occasion. One thing we'll need to do is we're going to have to make sacrifices. Once again, we look at Mark 9 and verse 43. This time we'll read the whole scripture. If your hand causes you to sin, cut it off. It is better for you to enter into life maimed than having two hands to go to hell into the fire that shall never be quenched. We need to be willing to make sacrifices, whatever those sacrifices may be, to find our spiritual, for our spiritual well-being. Most of you know Paul Rice, who used to attend here. He worked at Webb Will for years and years. And they changed his schedule, and he was having to miss Wednesday nights, you know, and he thought it was going to be temporary. And so he kept requesting to be moved off that shift, and they kept putting him off and kept putting him off, and it went on about a year. And finally he said, I can't do this. And he had a wife and a kid to support. And he quit his job because that job was not allowing him to do what he needed to do for his spiritual well-being. That takes guts. That takes guts. And, you know, here we are 20 years later. I'm still talking about it because that affected me. That impressed me that he was willing to do that for his spiritual well-being. I was sitting in a Bible class with Paul Sheehan. He was just in the class as well, but we were talking about marriage and divorce and those type of things. And he relayed a story of a friend of his out west that this man became a Christian. And after becoming a Christian, he realized that the marriage he was in was not a scriptural marriage. And he had kids in this marriage. This man got out of that marriage, bought another house in that same neighborhood, and lived two or three doors down so he could be able to fulfill his responsibilities as a father, but not live in that unscriptural marriage. That's somebody that's committed. That is somebody that is tough enough to step in and do what needs to be done. We need to be willing to point out what's wrong. We all know that's not easy to do. It is not easy to approach someone and point out something that might be wrong in their life. But we have to do it. The best example of this that you're probably already thinking about is Aquila and Priscilla in Acts chapter 18. And talking about Apollos, it says, "So he began to speak boldly in the synagogue. When Aquila and Priscilla heard him, they took him aside and explained to him the way of God more accurately." Now, obviously, that here we see that there is the right way to do things. But they were tough enough to stand up and do it. They had the courage to go to Apollos and correct his error. And thanks to that, we know the good that Apollos does later on in his preaching. So we need to be willing to do that. And I don't mean to be abusing Paul Rice tonight, but I got another example for him. One night, this was when I was in college, so I wasn't part of this, but he was always taking us kids to gospel meetings around the county. And one night, he took a bunch of kids from Bethesda, took them to a meeting, and someone was preaching on marriage and divorce. The speaker started preaching error on marriage and divorce. And Paul looked around. He said, "I've got all these kids with us. What do I need to do?" And so Paul, very politely, raised his hand. The preacher stopped and said, "Yes." He said, "Now, do I understand that you're saying so and so and so and so?" He said, "Yes." And he said, "That's not what's in the Bible." Now, I wasn't there. I didn't see the situation. He may have handled it differently. I don't know. But he had the courage to stand up and point out what was wrong, because he knew that he was being watched. And he had the courage to stand up and do that. And you know, the more we do these tough things that we've been talking about, the easier that they get. James 1 and verse 2. It says, "My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. But let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect and complete, and lack nothing." Knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. So that tells me the more you do things, the more tests you go through, the more trials you have, the more tough things you do, the easier it's going to become. There's a book that I'm very anxious to read, the whole book. I have not read the whole book. I've read snippets, but it's called Do Hard Things. And it's aimed at teenagers, but there's a lot of lessons for us. And it goes into how, you know, people like Alexander the Great and various people in history, you know, were leading armies or ruling the world by the time they were 20. And the whole point of the book is start early and take on these challenges. Don't set back and let them, you know, let somebody else do it or say, "I'm not ready for something like that." We need to grab things and take them and do them, and so that they can become easier to us. I figure there's several of you that have tried to play the guitar or do play the guitar. When you ever first started playing that guitar and you start fretting those strings, what happens the first couple days or weeks that you're doing that? Fingers get pretty sore, don't they? But then as long as you stay with it, what happens? Your fingers get tough. You can still feel the strings, but it ain't hurting anymore. And you can play, and then next thing you know, you're Chet Atkins. But, and then I figure there's several of you that have worked with barbed wire before. You know, me and Wes would go help Dad work on the fences. And, you know, me and Wes would be over there trying to, you know, get in between the barbs, you know. Because barbed wire is difficult to work with, mainly because it's called barbed wire. And so we're over here and we're trying to get in between the barbs, trying to get everything. We look over and Dad's just grabbing it like yarn and twisting it up and pulling on it. We just stop and look at each other and shake our heads. You know why? He's done it all of his life. It doesn't bother him, and plus he's got a little experience. He knows how to handle it. But even if he does get caught, it's not a big deal. His hands are so tough, he can work with it. And so the more you do something, the easier it gets to do tough things. So we start thinking about those that lived through the Great Depression. Now, those people learned to be tough. And there's some of you here. You know, I think it prepared that generation for the spiritual hard times that was faced in the church in the 50s and 60s. I think they learned to be tough enough to withstand that kind of pressure and that kind of trials that came through. Us younger generation, what have we had to face? Running out of Coke money? You know, maybe our car running out of gas here and there? What have we really had to face? Are we going to be tough enough when that next struggle comes? In one of the songs we sing, it says, "Should I be carried to the skies on flowery beds of ease, while others fought to win the prize and sailed through bloody seas?" You know, we're going to have to toughen up if we want to be able to say what the Apostle Paul said at the end of his life. "I have fought a good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith." If there's anything we can do for you tonight that can help you make your life right with God, then please come toward the front as we stand and sing.